Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Israel's 11-day assault on Gaza killed at least 254 Palestinians, including 66 children. 11 of those children were part of a Norwegian refugee council program to help them deal with the trauma of growing up under occupation and airstrikes. The children NRC assisted included 15-year-old Lina Iyad Shari, who was killed with both of her parents in their home on May 11th in Gaza's Al-Manara neighborhood. Her two-year-old sister Mina sustained third-degree burns and remains in critical condition. More than 1,900 people were injured. 2,000 buildings in Gaza were destroyed, including Gaza's largest bookstore and publishing house, and a 12-story tower that housed the bureaus of Al Jazeera and the AP. Over 52,000 Palestinians are now displaced within Gaza. 187 schools, including 55 preschools, were destroyed or damaged by Israeli bombardments, leaving thousands of Palestinian children unable to return to their classes, according to the Middle East Eye. The Committee to Protect Journalists condemned the killing of Palestinian radio journalist Yusuf Abu Hussein in Gaza and called on Israeli authorities to immediately clarify whether they deliberately struck his home. Amira Haruda, a freelance journalist and producer in Gaza, told Yahoo News that this latest assault was worse than the assaults in 2008, 2012, and 2014. And here is a clip of Amira Haruda.
You feel that everything, everyone, anything in Gaza is like a target for the Israeli army. To be honest, we don't feel it. It's like a real agreement with about ceasefire now in Gaza, because you cannot see like something signed in the paper. We can hear still the sound of the drones above our head 24 hours. And we know they are, you know, like observing and filming. And at the same time, when we looking for the statement from different Israeli militant persons, they are saying that, asking the army to get ready for another escalation with Gaza Strip. We don't feel that it's safe for us. The thing is that you feel that you are targeted. Every day I'm in the street working for journalists. I feel that it will be like the last day in my life. I don't think that there is a single word can express what I witnessed during these 11 days. When we are talking about this picture of little children, it's stuck in my mind. I don't think I will forget them at all.
And that is a clip of Amira Haruda, a freelance journalist and producer in Gaza City, speaking with Yahoo News. In Israel, 13 people were killed, including one Israeli child and a Palestinian girl living in Israel. That's according to the New York Times. On May 20th, Israel and Hamas called a ceasefire. Since then, Israeli police have launched a wave of arrests targeting Palestinians who took part in recent rallies. Last Thursday, the United Nations top human rights body voted to open an inquiry into abuses and possible war crimes committed in Israel and the occupied territories. Joining us to get an update on the aftermath of the assault on Gaza are two guests. Tariq Abu Halima is a social activist, artist, and project writer based in Gaza. Tariq is a project manager of Youth Influencers for Change. Hi, Tariq. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks, Tina, for having me.
Thank you. We're also joined by Awa al-Ghazawi, a Palestinian human rights activist in Gaza. She's worked as an English language teacher for the Palestinian Ministry of Education and has written for We Are Not Numbers, The Palestinian Project, and more. Aya lost her cousin during the 2008 assault on Gaza. Hi, Aya. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's start off with you. I'm sorry to hear about your cousin's death in the 2008 assault on Gaza. Can you just talk about, you know, how you, your families, and your loved ones are doing today?
Oh, thank you for this question. Actually, I've been in Gaza for my entire life, and I've survived three major Israeli aggressions before the latest one. So now I've survived four major Israeli aggressions on the Gaza Strip. It was absolutely the most brutal and the worst ever that I have witnessed. because Israel went insane. It targeted everybody. It didn't differentiate between civilians or non-civilians. It targeted residential buildings, towers, bookstores, even medical centers and the news agencies, schools. Nothing was spared. And this, you know, was in blatant violation not only of the international law but also of the Geneva Convention. And to be honest, it brought to me and to my family specifically very harsh memories, because as you said, in 2008 I lost my cousin. He was killed by an Israeli strike. At that time I was in the sixth grade. Maybe we're talking about I was in 11 years old, and I've got that devastating news. We were at home, and actually I was, when the 2008 assault began, I was at school doing my final exams. And then when I went home and we received the devastating news of the killing of my cousin, like, for a sudden we were frozen, and we didn't know what to do, because, you know, to lose somebody in a blink of an eye, it's not about losing a number. It's about losing a part of you, losing great memories, dreams, and this is something that we suffer from when you know, being reported in news outlets and media that Palestinians are reported as mere numbers and statistics, not as human beings, and we suffer from this process of dehumanization. But as we said, and back to the Israeli attack, actually it was horrible, and you know, everything in life was frozen. We didn't do anything. We didn't go to our jobs, our schools, our life was completely stopped. I mean, even before the Israeli attack, we suffered from hard life conditions. I mean, the UN expected Gaza to get to be uninhabitable by 2020, and now we're living in 2021, and we're living in a much worse life conditions. And now, adding to that, all those latest Israeli aggression, you know, the Gaza Strip is very tiny. We're talking about 360 square kilometers with a population of more than 2 million people. So wherever Israel had, there were people killed. There were homes flattened to earth. There were people dispossessed. Our children traumatized, extremely traumatized. I mean, before this Israeli aggression, we've been trying to recover from the Israeli assaults in 2014, and then even against our nonviolent protesters who took part in the Great Return March that was initiated in 2018. And this is horrible, because whatever Palestinians do, they are, you know, they're getting killed. I mean, the Great Return March, for example, is a peaceful, nonviolent march that Palestinians took to the street to demand the implementation of the Resolution 94, which was issued by the UN's General Assembly back in 1948 to stipulate very clearly the right of Palestinians to return, and the compensation for the suffering they have been enduring ever since 1948. But Israeli snipers, like, hey, targeted Palestinians in sensitive places of their bodies. It didn't take into consideration that they were nonviolently protesting. And then now in 2021, when Palestinians retaliated, and this is very important to emphasize, we didn't initiate this aggression. We just retaliated for what is happening in the Jerusalem, and still happening, actually. As everybody knows, like, Israel, you know, brutally attacked worshippers in Jerusalem, but also it attempts to ethnically cleanse Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, where there are 28 Palestinian families. That is about 500 Palestinians, and also 8 100 Palestinians in Salwan town, also in occupied Jerusalem. So, and this takes us back to the premise, to the, you know, the very establishment of Israel when it was established in 1948, the same day we call Palestinian catastrophe or Palestinian Nakba. Israel calls it the Independence Day. And it literally celebrates the Hitler colonial project, which was issued and was premised actually in the mass killing of Palestinians, the ethnic cleansing of them, you know, mass expulsion by force, massacres, heinous massacres committed against Palestinians. And people need to know this. It hasn't stopped. Ever since 1948, Palestinians have been subjected to Israeli brutality, to this multi-tiered system of oppression. The very nature of Israel, you know, is dependent on three things, which are, you know, settler colonialism, apartheid, and occupation. And Palestinians suffer from all those things all at once, wherever they are, whether they are living in Gaza or the West Bank, Jerusalem, even inside the 1948 territories. And Palestinians there also took part in the uprising. So basically, what we've been witnessing and still actually witnessing is a kind of uprising in the collective consciousness of Palestinians. You know, over the time, Israel tried to constitute a kind of, you know, different conditions for each sector of Palestinians. Like the life of Palestinians in the occupied 48 territories is quite different from Palestinians living under military occupation, direct one, in the West Bank and Gaza, or even in Jerusalem, whether in Eastern Jerusalem or Western Jerusalem. But all of Palestinians this time, you know, they've seen that now we're facing the same enemy. Like, it doesn't matter what form of racism we're suffering from. I mean, Palestinians in 1948 are treated as second and third class citizens, although they hold the Israeli citizenship. Here in Gaza, we have been besieged in Gaza for like more than 15 years now, as Israel imposed a medieval, a fatal siege on us since 2006. The same thing in the West Bank, because there are more than 635 checkpoints and that Palestinians have to go through all over the West Bank, and there is that apartheid wall and segregation, roads for Jewish only and other roads with bad infrastructure for Palestinians and non-Jewish, which is very racist. And then we have also many restrictions actually imposed on Palestinians in Jerusalem. They can't even hoist the Palestinian flag. They can't enchant anything about Palestine. And they get brutally attacked when practicing their right to worship. And so Palestinians actually have been suffering from all of this. There is no peace, there is no justice, no equality. And here in Gaza, we don't feel safe.
Aya, can I ask you, how old are you?
I'm 23 years old.
You're 23 years old. You brought up so many points there, and I want to make sure that Tariq can jump in and also add to this. But just to let listeners know, that's Aya Al-Ghazawi, a Palestinian human rights activist in Gaza. She writes for We Are Not Numbers. This is a website of Palestinian youth telling their stories. As you heard, she's only 23 years old, and she lost her cousin during the 2008 assault on Gaza. We're also joined by Tariq Abu Halima, a social activist, artist, and project writer in Gaza. He's project manager of Youth Influencers for Change. Tariq, first off, overall, comments on how you, your family, and your loved ones are doing.
Thanks, Tina, for having me again. Actually, this is a kind of tough question, or I might call it like not so easy to answer a question. On the individual level, actually, I have been trying to cope up after the attack on Gaza, as our lives came to a halt. Our lives stopped for a while, totally stopped for a while. And actually, I'm trying to cope up by getting back into my daily routine, into getting back into doing the regular things that I used to do. But things are not getting too easy in this regard. On the level of my family and the people I love, we lost so many. I lost two friends in these attacks, and there was a time in 2012 I lost a friend, and the casualties are not just restricted to the 240 people who were killed or the 1,700 people who were injured, but also they extend to include the people who have been harmed on the psychosocial level, on the mental health level. Mm-hmm. As an individual, I have been working with a non-profit organization called Youth Vision Society, and there was a program where we used to provide 670 university students with mental health and psychosocial support services. When we felt, most recently, we felt that we have achieved the desired results of the project. But when we felt so, as always, or as usual, sorry, an Israeli attack was launched against Gaza, and this has caused the beneficiaries or the targeted group to collapse again, which means, if you are going to generalize it, which means that everything in Gaza is meant to be pushed back by these attacks. So we are talking about the projects that can't achieve its results. I'm talking about one project. We are talking about individuals who cannot proceed with their lives. We are talking about a severe blockade that is meant to stop people's lives in a very brutal, slow way. And yes, so what I'm trying to say that these attacks are bringing, are getting us back, are just pushing us back. And it needs time. It really needs time to recover and to get back to function normally.
Tariq, I played the clip from Amira Haruda, a freelance journalist in Gaza, who said that this assault was worse than past assaults. It's very hard for people to comprehend. We see the videos, we hear interviews. Can you just talk about, I mean, Aya said that, you know, Gaza is a very small area. What is it like? I mean, it's kind of a strange question, but what is it like 11 days living under bombardment, not knowing if rockets are going to hit your area or even hit your home? I mean, how do you deal with that?
Actually, there were 11 days of terror and 11 days of horrible feelings. I can tell that these days were the worst of my lives. Although I have experienced three attacks launched by Israeli forces before the recent attack. I felt for a moment that everything was prone to be targeted, like nothing was spared to be as holy or as civilian or as, sorry, I don't know how to put it right, but everything everything was prone to be targeted. When the night came, we used to go downstairs because it is believed that when a house is bombed, it is the safest to safety place to go to is downstairs. We were extremely terrified. Yes. I think these attacks, the recent attack was the most horrible.
Can we spend a couple minutes talking about how this affects children and young people? Tarek, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 24 years old. Yes.
Do you have access to, trauma programs? I mentioned in the intro that 11 of the 66 children who were killed were part of a Norwegian Refugee Council program to help them deal with the trauma of growing up under occupation and airstrikes. Tarek, what services are available for children and young people like you and Aya?
Actually, not so much service is provided in this area. But I can say that there were signs of trauma on that most people I know have been showing. Like people have been isolating themselves, depressed. They were showing signs of frustration. People tend not to talk a lot. I think all of these signs are meant to be signs of trauma and signs of negative feelings. But talking about whether services, adequate services, are provided in this regard for people in the Gaza Strip, I can say that if there are services, they don't exceed to target 5% of the people in Gaza.
Aya, what would you add?
I actually second what Tarek said about that the 11 days of the aggression was absolutely terrifying. Our children were weeping all the time because there were very heavy bombardments and airstrikes everywhere, indiscriminately, of course. And the thing is that the aggression came at the very same time that we were supposed to be celebrating Al-Fitr Eid, which is an occasion that Muslims celebrate after the holy month of Ramadan. It marks the end of Ramadan, the month of fasting. So before the aggression, we were preparing for this celebration. We went shopping to buy new clothes, and we went to buy ingredients of very popular Palestinian cuisine. We were very much enthusiastic to celebrate because that was time of family gatherings and visits. And then came the Israeli aggression at the last 2 days of Ramadan and right before Eid. That was, alone, that was something very much devastating, not only to children, but also to everybody, the Gaza Strip. After the 2014 assault, like when the UN did many researches, it concluded that more than 290,000 Palestinian children in urgent need for psychotherapy. To me, I think all Palestinians living in Gaza need this kind of therapy because we don't have enough, programs of this kind to support and to deal with the trauma. I myself am very much traumatized. I'm still hearing the sounds of explosions just right in my head. They keep occurring. And to me, I've decided to enroll in music courses because maybe this would help me replace these sounds of explosions with music. I did this because I am conscious of the importance of music. But here in Palestine, in Gaza in particular, we don't have this kind of luxury. I work as a teacher, and I can't support myself in this regard. But I assure that Palestinians in Gaza don't have this luxury because, you know, as I said, we are 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, and two-thirds of those 2 million are refugees. I am myself a refugee. 80% of the population in Gaza are dependent on international aid. They barely can cater for the basic necessities, and we have, for example, 97% of course of the water we use is undrinkable. We have a very high rate of poverty, a very high rate of unemployment, especially the life in Gaza is quite gloomy actually, because there are no opportunities. There is no life that I can describe as a dignified life for our youth and for our children. Many Palestinian youth actually have been considering leaving the Gaza Strip. Of course, we don't have legal immigration, so that they choose to take risk and immigrate illegally. And many of them were killed. I mean, they sank in the seas and oceans on their ways to European countries. So I'm just asking, like, for how long have Palestinians, to live through these circumstances, to live this brutal massacre over and over again, the ethnic cleansing, the mass, actually, the genocide, and the apartheid, and Israel is officially an apartheid as described by, you know, human rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch and even the Israeli leftist organization, B'Tselem. Unless Israel is held into account, it will continue, committing massacres against Palestinians, especially that it has a green light from the U.S. It is supported by the U.S. Mm. It uses U.S.-made warplanes and drones against us. And, you know, they have your tax money. They have your tax money because the U.S. supports Israel every year with $3.8 billion as part of the military aid. So, and then the U.S. comes and tries to intermediate to, impose a kind of ceasefire. So why are you supporting Israel in the first place? Why are you allowing Israel to use your weapons, to use your tax money against Palestinian civilians, Palestinian children and women, elderly men? I mean, they killed 280 Palestinians. There were 69 children. There were 17 elderly people. There were more than 39 women. And as you said, 11 of the children killed were taken a Norway program for psychotherapy support. So actually, I think there is a moral obligation that people around the world should stop for a moment and ask themselves, because you can do a lot, actually.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Aya Al-Ghazawi, a Palestinian human rights activist in Gaza. She's worked as an English language teacher for the Palestinian Ministry of Education and has written for We Are Not Numbers, Palestinian Youth Telling Their Own Stories. Aya lost her cousin during the 2008 assault on Gaza. She is just 23. Tariq Abu Halima is a social activist, artist, and project manager of Youth Influencers for Change. He has lost many friends during these assaults, and he is just 24. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on 91.7 KALW. Frameline 45, San Francisco International LGBTQ+ Film Festival, celebrates 45 years of groundbreaking cinema with 17 days of films showcasing queer stories from around the globe. Presenting unique narrative features, documentaries, and discussion panels, Frameline 45 runs June 10th through the 27th, with films streamed nationally and presented at 5 Bay Area outdoor and in-theater venues.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about what daily life is like for Palestinians living in the occupied territories and Israel. Human Rights Watch just came out with a massive report accusing Israel of committing crimes of apartheid and persecution. And so we will discuss that tomorrow. Today, we are talking about two young people in Gaza, about the aftermath of the 11-day assault on Gaza. Tariq Abu Halima is a social activist, artist, and project manager of Youth Influencers for Change. Aya Al-Ghazawi is a Palestinian human rights activist in Gaza. She's worked as an English language teacher and has written for We Are Not Numbers. Aya lost her cousin during the 2008 assault on Gaza. Tariq, what would you add to what Aya said about the United States giving $3.8 billion to Israel every year, and then there's a plan for $735 million in U.S. weapons sales to Israel. What would you say to our listeners about this support?
Actually, I'd say that Gaza doesn't need all of this. Gaza has been depicted as an equal power of Israel, which is totally wrong, which is totally not right. Gaza has been blockaded for 15 years, and thus people in Gaza haven't been having access to their essential daily needs. How they could be able to have access to military stuff. So I think that the USA is exaggerating their support of Israel, and I think that Israel is using their myth of self-defense to more exploit the USA and other countries who are expected to support them on the grounds of that Israel is self-defending itself again. I never wished for these attacks to last for an extra day, because as these attacks continued, the Israeli Air Forces were finding excuses to take more innocent civilian lives on the grounds of self-defense again. And as you know, this myth has been insupportable since day one. Yet so many people, and so I don't mean people, so many governments around the world prefer to believe it, and even worse, promote it in multiple ways, like the way that the USA government now is doing, which has led such an evil force, I mean the Zionist movement, to proceed with its horrendous work in Palestine. Actually, my great hope is that the latest attack, the latest Israeli-provoked attack, would provide an ironclad proof for everyone concerned with the Palestinian issue that this aggression was never about self-defense, as so many people in Gaza and nine families were wiped off the civil register, knowing that and given the fact that Israel as a government has access to each and every individual name in Gaza as the occupier of Palestine and as the state that is blockading the Gaza Strip. And that's how Israeli forces were able to make calls and to tell people, okay, you can leave this home, we are going to bomb it. Okay, why didn't you in the first place make sure that you were not going to to bomb children and bomb families and bomb women as well and young people. I think that the USA is exaggerating. I think that the Gaza Strip doesn't need all of this. Like, it is a very marginalized area that is suffering high rates of poverty, high rates of unemployment, high rates of psychosocial problems. I mean, on the psychosocial level, everything is deteriorating to the max. And I think also that Israel is using the its myth of self-defense to further exploit the USA government and the USA people by taking advantage of their taxes in favor of self-defending themselves. And I don't call it self-defense again. I don't know what to call it. Is it thirsty for blood? I still don't know. And yes, actually our requirements for the truce were, I mean, the resistance in Gaza requirements for the truce were clearly plain from the very beginning. Just to stop the ethnic cleansing that you are launching in Sheikh Jarrah and you are launching in Salwan. And these types of ethnic cleansing are still going on. The resistance in Gaza didn't start from the first place to provoke this these attacks or to provoke such work, but they were asking and they were constantly asking Israel to stop what it is doing from ethnic cleansing and depopulation of Palestinians in Jerusalem, in Sheikh Jarrah. And
Tariq, since you brought up Sheikh Jarrah, can you give us a little bit of context here and some background? I just want to read from a BBC piece called Jerusalem Sheikh Jarrah, The Land Dispute in the Eye of a Storm. Samira Dajani and Adele Buderi's garden feels like an oasis, a peaceful place of bougainvillea, lavender, and shady fruit trees at the center of a furious incendiary dispute which helped to trigger a conflict. The Palestinian couple's single-story stone house in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah is one of 14 where Palestinian residents, 300 people in all, face eviction to make way for Jewish settlers in a case that has made it all the way to Israel's Supreme Court. The process was halted as violence erupted in Jerusalem just before the latest fighting between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Can you tell us just a little bit more about what's going on here and give us an update?
Actually, an Israeli settler summed up the whole situation in regard to Sheikh Jarrah when he was shooted, saying that if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it. And he means by someone else is going to steal it, another settler is going to steal it. So actually this systematic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians is meant by Israel. So as Palestinians were peacefully living in Sheikh Jarrah, they were asked to leave their homes forcibly, and thus settlers would be able to occupy these places and to settle in these places instead of Palestinians, knowing that they have no rights in these areas. Knowing that these areas, these very areas, belong to Palestinians, and they and Palestinians have been living there for the last 100 years. So you are talking about systematic ethnic cleansing that is launched allegedly to be legally by the government of Israel. And as those people are meant to leave their homes, these homes are meant as well to be dwelt by Israeli settlers. And again, Yaqub, who is an Israeli settler, summed up the whole situation when he said, and you can Google the footage, if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it. It is mere theft.
And we'll find that interview. Is this Vice News Inside the Battle for Jerusalem? I think that's what you're referring to. We'll find that and link to it. We've got about 15 or so minutes left. I want to ask you about the international solidarity that's been happening around the globe. What have been your reactions to this renewed support that we're seeing around the world and in so many countries around the globe?
Well, at the time that we were witnessing escalating normalization with Israel and total complicity of many governments around the world, one of them, of course, the U.S., we were, and I was actually, very overwhelmed by the solidarity we've seen by Palestinians themselves, Arabs, and even, the people around the world. And therefore, we always say that we don't expect any good to come from the governments, but actually what we are relying on is the people themselves and the grassroots movements. We were very much relieved to see massive demonstrations, thousands of people taken to the street to commemorate the 73rd anniversary of the Palestine Nakba, in response to a call issued by the civil community of in Palestine. That was something to remember for, you know, like forever. I just want to mention an important point that Tariq talked about, which is the reporting of our struggle in news media. Because yes, I saw in many outlets that there was an attempt to portray the Palestinian struggle as a struggle between two equal sides, which is absolutely not true, because we're talking about the fourth strongest army in the world. And the only state that has nuclear hits, about 245 nuclear hits in the region, that is Israel, against a population, a Palestinian people who are striving for their right to self-determination, who are represent a liberation movement. We have the full right to our self determination. We want peace, but there is no peace without achieving justice. So if you want to describe the Palestinian struggle, I would actually use that it is a liberation movement seeking for justice, equality, and the freedom. And without those, no peace can be achieved, absolutely. But back to the demonstrations and the solidarity, that was absolutely something to talk about, but I think this needs to continue. I don't want to talk about it as just a moment with this uprising and then that's it. No, we still need other forms of solidarity other than the demonstrations, which again is very important. But I think there are other potent ways and effective joined the Palestinian struggle against the settler colonial and apartheid state of Israel. And one of these is to endorse the boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS movement, which, basically calls for boycotting Israel on all levels, whether, economically, sports, culturally, academically, because this movement was inspired by the movement, the boycott movement in South Africa last century, when there was an apartheid system regime there, and it worked. It really worked. So we're trying to do the same to isolate Israel from the world until it ends its war crimes, like crimes against humanity, and complies by the international law. And I think this is not much to ask for. And we actually, we need to say that we are also fed up of calling for racist solutions such as the two-state solution. I think the latest aggression, Israeli aggression on Gaza, you know, put the last, you know, the last mark in the coffin of the two-state solution, because it is racist. It goes against the very core of the Palestinian cause, which is the refugees' cause. It doesn't guarantee my right to return to Yaffa, which is my native city. It doesn't, you know, and it goes against even the very basic human rights of Palestinians. And, you know, it's absolutely impractical because Israel still goes on with the annexation plans and establishing further illegal settlements on occupied Palestinian territories. And I think the best thing that we can call for is the dismantling of this multitude system of oppression that Israel represents, namely settler colonialism, apartheid, and occupation. Once this system is dismantled, there will be no need to talk about solutions, because there will be no issue. And I envisage a future where everybody lives in a one democratic state with equal rights. And this is a very generous offer by us, the indigenous population of Palestine, to Israeli settlers. Of course, on condition that they get rid of this Zionist mentality and racist ideology. Zionism must be, sent to the dustbin of history. But again, there is something also very critical to be discussed, which is the criticism of Israeli racist policies is portrayed as anti-Semitism. This accusation is used to silence Palestinians and to silence the pro-Palestinians. We have the right to criticize what Israel is doing, because it's not about something usual that is happening and that we should just turn a deaf ear to this. No. We need to call Israel what it is. We need to call a spade a spade. We shouldn't be afraid to speak out. And I think that it is ridiculous to call us anti-Semitic, because we are ourselves Semites. The Arab origin and this history. So I think that these are critical issues to be discussed, listened and even studied in syllabus and curriculum.
And Tarek, what would you add? What are your thoughts about the international solidarity that you're seeing around the globe? And, you know, what, as a 24-year-old, what are your thoughts about what's next? I mean, I was listening to interviews with Palestinians who said that the rebuilding from the last assault, the 2014 assault, hasn't been done. And so what needs to happen to ensure that this doesn't happen again and again?
Yes. We are so proud of the international solidarity that we have reach to, and we are so much grateful for such solidarity. Actually, one thing is good about the latest attacks, and nothing is good about it, but I'm going to call it as an advantage for the Palestinian people all over Palestine, not in Gaza, that the Palestinian cause has been brought up to the center stage again. Comparing what is happening in Palestine to other regions like in Yemen, Libya, Syria, and so on, we felt for a moment that we were going to live this nightmare forever. I mean, the Israeli nightmare. But now we feel that we are heard by most people around the world. And there is an important thing that we always differentiate between people and the governments. As you see, the U.S. government is totally biased to Israeli, I mean, their policies. when it comes to Israeli-Palestinian struggle, but we believe in the power of the people of the USA. I have been contacting with so many people from the USA, and they never failed to show solidarity, to talk about the Palestinian cause and to defend the Palestinian rights. And through such work, we feel that our voices were given the opportunity to be heard again. I think that there was something that Israeli forces this time didn't take into account, that it's not the role of traditional media anymore that pushes the people forward. Now we have social networking sites that reach out to so many people around the world away from the traditional media. I'm comparing the traditional media with the social networking sites like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, because I believe that traditional media, without naming them in specific, worldwide have been biased to the Israeli narrative and to the Israeli standpoint. But now, as influencers all around the world did their own research, their personally driven research, they found out the truth, and thus they didn't fail to convey it to the people around the world, and thus people have got the opportunity to hear about us, to hear our narrative, to see what's really happening on the grounds. Actually, Israeli media, Israeli biased media outlets always succeeded in putting up, in setting up that filter between what's happening on the grounds and what Israel is doing on the grounds and what Israel is conveying to the world. This filter didn't have any room when it came to the social networking sites and when it came to today's media. So I attribute most of this success to the social networking sites that were not taken into consideration by Israel and by the Zionist movement. We did great work. We networked with people from inside Palestine. What's so special about, what's so different about this attack that we in Gaza...
Tariq, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are out of time. Tariq Aboulima is a social activist, artist, and project manager of Youth Influencers for Change, and Aya Al-Ghazawi has worked as an English language teacher in Gaza, and she also writes for We Are Not Numbers. Tariq and Aya, thank you so much for joining us.